Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Wednesday, June 2nd. I'm Ray Graff. Boy, are you lucky today, because astronomer extraordinaire Bob Berman is in the house. Bob stops by every couple of days to do Vox Pop, and he's one of the best-known, most widely read astronomers in the world. His latest book, written with Robert Lanza, M.D., is Beyond Biocentrism. It is out. We'll talk about that. We'll talk about the close proximity of Mars and Saturn, the closest in about a decade, and lots of exciting things to talk about. We may even talk about some of NASA's ambassador programs are very exciting. Give us a call now, 800-348-2551, 800-348-2551. Yes, boys and girls, Bob Berman is in the house. The show begins after the news. Hello once again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. This afternoon, we welcome back Bob Berman for his monthly visit to this program to field all of your astronomy-related questions. Bob is one of the most widely read astronomers in the whole wide world, and his latest book is Beyond Biocentrism, Rethinking Space-Time, Consciousness, and the Illusion of Death. It's written with Robert Lanza, M.D. It's a great read, but full disclosure, I didn't know you were on today and didn't start the program, the reading program. You know, Bob, weren't you on like 2 weeks ago?
No, it was a whole month.
Was it really?
Yes. It's just.
I thought you were on after the fun drive, and I said, hey, you know what, I'll read it during the fun drive.
No, that's what's happening to time.
You see? Nice tie-in. The number to call here is 800-348-2551. 800-348-2551. Also, full disclosure, our producer, Jessica Blaustein Marshall, not here today. So once again, I will be manning the email at voxpop@wamc.org. If I miss your email, it's because I'm generally at a very low level of competence in most things that I do. But I'll give my best shot here. So if you do have an email, it's voxpop@wamc.org. But again, the number here on this call-in program is 800-348-2551. In addition to Bob Berman, we also have Charles Fulco in the studio, who is a NASA Solar System Ambassador. You get to wear a fez or anything? Any kind of funny outfit when you're an ambassador?
Just a crown every now and then.
A crown. Oh, that's great. Well, nice to have you here. And anything pops up in your realm of expertise, we will hand it over to you. Then, Bob, this one came in regarding your book. This one came in like a week ago from regular correspondent Al in Clifton Park. He may have his tongue in his cheek here. I don't know. His question is this, and I quote, "Under biocentrism, how does one think and talk about history? For example, thinking about President Obama's birthplace, what does it mean to say Obama was born in Honolulu on his birthday versus the claim that he was born elsewhere? In other words, what is the meaning and significance of history under biocentrism?"
Well, we don't say that there's no relative history or relative time. It would be foolish for us to claim that that New York City wasn't the way it looked in the 1880s or 1860s. We just say that, first of all, and it's not us, quantum mechanics and before that Einstein showed us that time simply is not a real item. It's not like a crystal or cottage cheese or something you can take to the lab and analyze. Rather, it's a way that we animals make sense of the enormous avalanche of electrical signals that are always flooding through our brains. We see things changing. And so we create this matrix of what we call time, 24 hours in a day, et cetera. But that doesn't mean it really has reality. So not to be confused with an actual history of things. Nonetheless, quantum mechanics is showing us that when we observe something, let's say a particle, a cosmic ray that comes in from another part of the universe. In the old days, we'd say, well, we're observing it travel in a certain way, so we know that it must have been in such and such other place at an earlier time. No. Now physicists tell us only the observation is the reality, and that the assumption that it was somewhere else in an earlier time is an assumption that may or may not be true, because the universe is made of particles, and all of these particles only come into actual existence upon observation, so that all that is really real is the observation, and the rest are thoughts or ideas or analyses of them, which may be likely, but isn't necessarily true.
Yeah, I don't buy it.
Don't.
I don't buy it.
That's fine, but you have to read the book.
All right, all right. Fair enough. And, well, let's go to the phones here, and let's see who we have on the line. Robert in Catskill. Robert, you're on.
Good afternoon, Dr. Berman. And after that last one, this is rather simplistic.
Please.
On Monday, I was at the drive-in theater, and between the clouds, there was a little bit of a break where the stars were visible. And about, I'd say, low in the sky, facing almost direct east, around 10 o'clock in the evening, there was one star which was very different in the sense that the Kelvin temperature was much lower, I'd say 3,400 degrees.
Mars.
And it was Mars?
Yes, yes, you saw Mars.
You answered my question before I even answered it.
It's very close.
It didn't appear to be a single pinpoint. It appeared to be maybe a little bit something. I was, you know, I had no binoculars or anything, but it was just, I thought it was a planet.
Yes, yes, quite right, and an excellent observation, and I'm so glad you said it. It's almost as if we planted you in the listenership audience, because I really wanted to mention that just this Monday night, Mars came closest to Earth since 2006, and it is this week in particular absolutely brilliant. It is that orange, and when you said low Kelvin temperature, I know that's a euphemism for that it looked on the ruddy, reddish side, right?
Sure. And I'm a photographer, so I think in those terms.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. It's yellow-orange in color. It's the brightest thing that's low in the east or southeast, if you really want to be exact. You said 10 o'clock. That's precisely the time.
It was southeast. That was correct. I was in the drive-in theater and watching the movies.
Yes, terrific. Yes. And 10 o'clock is when it really starts to clear the horizon. 11 o'clock, it even gets up a little higher. And what's interesting is that tonight, Saturn joins it for its closest and brightest in also about a decade, and not closest but brightest in a decade, and Saturn is just to Mars's left. So looking low in the southeast at 10 o'clock, even 11 o'clock, the brightest star-like thing is going to, and definitely orange colored, that's Mars. Look well to its left, and the second brightest star out there, if you know a little astronomy and how the number magnitude measurement system goes, Saturn is exactly magnitude zero, the same magnitude as Vega, which is higher up and which is bluish. And Mars is minus, almost minus two.
Which brilliant. Means it's brighter.
Absolutely, yeah, even brighter, even more dazzling. And what a thing for two planets to both reach their close, not only closest to Earth of the year, but brightest in a decade on the same week in the same part of the sky. And so that's what we're treated for. And as the caller pointed out, just seeing it naked eye, even without a telescope, is very impressive.
So why, if Saturn is not at its closest, is it at its brightest?
Well, it is at its closest for the year. I just didn't. Mars is at its closest in 10 years. I didn't want to say Saturn is at its closest in 10 years. Actually, the Saturnian oppositions don't differ that much because the Saturn orbit is a rounder orbit than Mars has. The difference in the eccentricity or the squashedness of the orbits is very interesting. Venus, for example, has the roundest orbit of every planet. If a perfectly round orbit is zero and an absolutely squashed ellipse is one, Venus is 0.007. Boy, that's round. If you were an alien looking at it from above, you could not tell that it's not a perfect circle.
Yeah.
The planet inside of it, Mercury, has the most eccentric orbit of all the real planets. Now that poor Pluto has been demoted, its eccentricity is 0.2. Yeah. It's pretty darn eccentric. That means it comes much closer to the sun sometimes than others. Earth is sort of in between the two. We're pretty round orbit. Mars is the second most eccentric orbit with an eccentricity of 0.09. That's pretty eccentric. But Saturn is twice as round. So this is a long-winded way of saying that as we go around the sun and then form a lineup once a year with Saturn, the difference between its distance from one year, from one meeting to another meeting, is not that great. What makes Saturn so very bright is that its rings are now tilted almost maximally. It's tilted about 26 degrees toward us. And just 8 years ago, they were edgewise to us. So the rings are twice as shiny.
This would be the time to get the telescope.
Yeah. Oh, yes, yes, indeed. Mars tends to disappoint through a telescope. Both planets have the same size disk, 18 arc seconds tonight. That's odd, by the way, that they both look the same, because Saturn is 18 times farther from us than Mars is.
Yeah.
But because it's so much larger inherently, it's 78,000 miles in diameter. Mars is only 4,200 miles in diameter. They both are the same size in appearance.
Yeah.
But because of those giant rings surrounding Saturn, that gives Saturn an extra boost. It's shiny. The rings are even shinier. And so my question to you,
Ray,
is if Saturn is so much shinier and so much inherently larger, and if both the planets have the same apparent disk, why is Mars six times brighter looking?
Okay, so Mars is closer, and they have, because of the distance, they have the same size disk in our sky. We're viewing it. And, well, reflectivity is the issue?
Saturn is more reflective than Mars is.
Okay. Well, then it has to be, I don't know.
Well, the first thing you said was right. It's closer.
Right.
And so a closer object is going to appear inherently brighter. And the second reason is, Charles, what would you say?
Well, I used to teach about what's called the inverse square law of light.
Ah, yes. We've talked about that in this program.
Okay, so that's basically, as you double the distance, you lose the square of that distance in intensity. So if something moves twice as far away, you're only seeing about a quarter of the light.
Okay, so the moon then should be almost as bright as the sun, right?
Well, the moon is 450,000 times dimmer than the sun because it's just a poor reflector of light. The moon, you know, the moon is as dark as asphalt, so that if some insane developer, if Trump went and paved the entire moon,
to get into politics, really?
Turned it into a giant parking lot. The moon would not get any darker than it already looks because it reflects really a paltry about 10% of the light that hits it. So the answer is that Mars is in brighter sunlight because it's closer into the sun.
Okay.
Much brighter sunlight.
Yeah, that makes sense, sure.
And the other thing you said, it's closer to us, so the light has less of a chance to get lost and dissipate from greater distance.
All right. The phone number here is 800-348-2551. By the way, I want to thank Kermit for writing in just at 2 o'clock, just after I did the billboard, who says, Joe, unless you're in a time warp, it is Thursday and not Wednesday. I guess I said it was Wednesday today.
Did you?
It was in the script. Oh. I'm like Ron Burgundy. I read whatever they put in front of me. Thank you, Kermit, for pointing that out. By the way, it's not Joe, it's Ray. So we're even. We're both wrong.
Support comes from Colby Attorney Service, document filing, document and information retrieval, and other services including legal publishing and corporate record searches. ColbyService.com. The Albany Pinebush, presenting Tales from the Taverns at the Albany Pump Station with stories about historic sites that once hosted travelers passing through the Pinebush. June 18th at 4 p.m., albanypinebush.org. Ballston Spa Veterinary Clinic, dedicated to serving clients and their pets of Saratoga County and beyond for over 80 years. Open 7 days a week with extended hours. BalstonSpaVet.com. Arkell Museum at Canajoharie, presenting Edward Bike, picturing the American Revolution, juxtaposing a 20th century view of the Revolutionary War with 18th century portraits. ArkellMuseum.org. Viva Fresh Pasta, 30 years and 30 wines by the glass, European cuisine infused with flavors of the world. Northampton, Massachusetts, grab life by the knife and fork. VivaFreshPasta.com. And Grapes and Grains Wine and Spirits, East Greenbush, New York, specializing in wine and craft spirits for more than 15 years, stocking single malts, bourbons, tequilas, and gins. GrapesandGrainsWine.com.
All right, Bob Bourbon, you gave me an astronomy quiz. I'll give you a music quiz. Who is that?
No idea.
It was Jeff Beck, Beck's Bolero. Now, who wrote it?
Beck.
No, Jimmy Page wrote it. You see? Yeah, right. We're even. By the way, our lockbox is open at WAMC.org. Thus far, we have raised, all right, Bob, how much have we raised?
$301,000.
Oh, you're so close. So close. $338,838 as of 2 p.m. in the WAMC lockbox. The fund drive starts on Monday at 6 a.m. with Alan Shartok and myself. And we will be having a great time and raising money to keep this radio station alive. But if you want to do your part now, we would love you to make a pledge at the old lockbox, WAMC.org. And we have things for a $100 pledge. Bob, I know you'll be impressed with this, or at least pretend that you are. This is the new Super Premium. This is it's a black T-shirt. And as you see, it's got our WAMC logo.
It looks like a supernova a little bit.
Yeah, I always thought it was a depiction of radiation around a microphone. Yep. And then on the back, it says vote WAMC because it's an election year, you see? And with that, you get a nice vote for WAMC coffee mug. And you don't have to give $100. It's just one way to get you to that level. But anything you can do, we'd love to hit the $400,000 mark by the start of the drive on Monday morning. So it's WAMC.org. We're joined today by Bob Berman, who is our resident astronomer here and the author of Beyond Biocentrism with Robert Lanza, Rethinking Space-Time Consciousness and the Illusion of Death. Also today by NASA Solar System Ambassador Charles Fulco. What do you do as a solar system ambassador?
If I told you, I'd have to kill you.
Really? Really?
Actually, it was a really cool position because I ended up taking a year off from school where I taught in Portchester to take this position that was offered to me to become a sort of a kind of an advance notice person for the 2017 total solar eclipse coming on.
Okay, so they're not sending you to like Venus to talk to the natives.
Not yet.
Okay, because that would be a real
My
ambassador.
My girlfriend might like to some days.
I see what you're saying there. So the solar eclipse is coming in 2017?
Yes.
And will it be seen in Portchester?
About 76% of it will be, but that's not where you want to be at all.
No.
You want to be in the path of totality.
Here in the Capital District, it'll be cloudy anyway.
Yeah,
it's
right.
What it happens around here. This one came in via email, Bob. Are you ready?
Sure.
This one, the subject heading is The Big Freeze. Good afternoon. Thanks for another interesting show. Well, I think you're overstating it. I read a book recently, cannot remember the title, that talked about the ever-expanding universe and how it will end with a whimper, dark and cold, in a time so distant in the future that I couldn't get my head around that scale. Is the Big Freeze for real? This is from Paul, who says he's reading one of your books now, Bob.
Great.
So best answer this question correctly.
Okay. Well, bless his two-chambered heart.
Nice. That's nice, Bob. No,
actually, I guess it's
your
frogs.
Readers.
Frogs have two-chambered
right.
hearts.
Sorry, Paul.
Okay. If dark energy is what we think it is, and we've only known about it since 1998, but there seems to be good evidence that the emptiness of space has a anti-gravity ability, has a power. You could think of it as vacuum energy.
Zero point energy?
Or zero point energy. It's another thing it's called because it starts to really become noticeable at absolute zero, when you remove all other atomic and molecular motion at 459.67 degrees below zero Fahrenheit, you're at this point of parity with it. And it seems to be that empty space has a pushing ability, so that as the universe after the Big Bang reached a certain point of emptiness, when it was half its present age, we're talking about something like 7 billion years ago.
Okay.
This emptiness of space started pushing everything, and the emptier space got, the faster it's pushing it, so that the universe, which was expanding more and more slowly, reversed itself and started expanding faster and faster. Now, at first, this made no sense, because for the universe to start expanding faster 7 billion years ago would be as if every cluster of galaxies had rocket engines on them that all ignited simultaneously, and the universe is blasting itself apart faster and faster at an ever-increasing rate.
Okay.
Well, that really seems to be happening, and the only thing we can figure out why is that emptiness has a pushing ability. Now, we know nothing more about it. We give it a name. We call it dark energy, but we know nothing more about it. But if it's true, then the caller is right. And as the universe gets more and more empty, it becomes more and more empty until everything becomes cold, isolated, lonely, dark. And that's the bleak future of the cosmos. But wait.
Okay.
There is an escape clause. The escape clause is that we know nothing about dark energy. So how do we know that at a certain point it doesn't reverse itself, or that some other thing that we don't know about kicks into place? Also, this may not be the only universe. Also, the universe may be infinite in nature and in extent and in inventory, in which case anything that happens to any neighborhood like ours doesn't affect the whole.
So the whole thing is blind speculation and nobody knows anything. Is that the bottom line?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Let's go back to the phones. 800-348-2551. Sean and Kinderhook, you're on. Sean.
Hey, guys. Thanks for taking my call. I wanted to bring up something that Carl Sagan said a very long time ago. I was watching one of his programs. He said that one leaf on one tree has as many atoms in it as there are stars in the entire galaxy. And I found that to be pretty fascinating. And, you know, I came up with my own theory. And I said everyone and everything, both living and non-living, either directly or indirectly, are part of this intricate and infinite puzzle that I believe is the known universe. So, but what I kind of wanted to really talk about was extraterrestrials. Does anybody believe in that? And if so, my theory is that extraterrestrials are just us, maybe 250 million years from now, and they're just traveling back in time.
So there's only one set of extraterrestrials?
Well, I don't know. Now, I mean, from what I understand, they say that there's several different kinds.
Well, the kinds that are coming here, you mean?
Yeah.
Because, I mean, we don't really know if there's any life anywhere until they find one little microbe on some other place that's not Earth, then it's all speculation, right? You have that Drake equation, right, that goes back to 1960. And I don't know. What do you think, Bob?
So many ways to answer this. I'd say the fundamental way, again, going back to beyond biocentrism, because this is a big topic in it, is that the universe or nature is correlative with life. In other words, when we're looking for life, there's no place that isn't life, and that everything that seems to be external, including distant galaxies, since we know it has no visual reality until we look at it, since quantum mechanics is showing us that no atoms of which the universe is made of pop into existence except for observation, what we go back is showing for at least the last 75, 80 years that the observer and nature are correlative. In other words, we go hand in hand, we go together. There is no dead universe out of which life evolved. If anything, it's the other way around. It's that the universe evolved from the conscious life that which exists. So when we're looking for extraterrestrial life, first, let's get real about what the nature of the whole universe is. And if we're not separate, if the universe is not separate from life, well, you start with that. But okay, let's not be cutesy. Let's talk in terms of here's a ball on which we have life crawling on the surface, our planet Earth. What the caller is talking about is, are there other balls that have life on them? And it just seems, given that there are amino acids filling the universe, the building blocks of life, the proteins that make up life, flood even the most distant nebulae. We see especially the simpler ones like lysine, but all of them are out there. Given that we have water with warmth and energy sources, and now we're seeing them on Europa, on Enceladus, and in other places in the solar system. We know that life on Earth started in these. It would seem, you know, if I were a gambling man and you'd say, is it more likely that we find life in the oceans, the saltwater oceans of Europa, than we don't? I'd say, yeah, yeah. There'd be more of an explanation that we'd need if it didn't have life than if it does.
All right, Sean, thanks a lot for the call, 800-348-2551. And I think most of the scientific community you read, at least online, would tend to think that there is life out there. But my point is, until you can prove one thing exists that is alive, it's all speculation.
Right. Absolutely.
Let's go to line two. And Paul in Hinsdale, Mass. Paul, you're on with the legendary Bob Berman.
Hey, Bob. Hi, Ray. How are you?
Good.
You had another caller earlier named Paul. He had a question about the expansion theory. Well, I'm not the same guy, but I have been pondering this and trying to grapple the concept of an expanding universe. And I had a notion, and it's based on, well, first of all, it seems that the theory supports or is supported by the premise, based on our observation of the red shift, that the distant objects are moving farther away at a faster rate. And then also the theorized existence of the dark energy throughout the universe. Given that we know extremely little about the properties of the dark force, my question is, could it be something about it that distorts the red shift, augmenting the effect, making the perception of distant objects moving away faster?
Yes.
And I had just two points I wanted to make. Since there's, well, exponentially more volume of space between us and the distant objects, there'd be more dark force kind of contributing to this factor or perception. And the second point was, if this were the case, seems to me it would resolve any conflicts with breaking the relativity constraints of objects moving faster than the speed of light.
Okay. First of all, there's no relativity constraints, because as we look farther and farther and see objects expanding faster and faster, and I'll get back to your other point of how we know this is so, it's we actually reach a point where we see objects that are receding at almost light speed and know that there are the vast majority of the universe, vast majority, at least 1,000 times more than what we can see, is expanding faster than the speed of light. Some say an infinite number of galaxies is expanding faster than the speed of light. So how is that possible? Did they violate relativity? And the answer is no, because they never had to get accelerated faster and faster, because it's the empty space between us and them that's inflating. So there's no actual masses of galaxies that had to gain energy by accelerating, and therefore they don't violate relativity at all. Now, how do we know that they're expanding at this rate? One, of course, is the red shift. There used to be desperate attempts, especially by people like Halton Arp and others. There are some clusters of galaxies that where they all seem to be at the same distance, but one has a greater red shift than all the other galaxies that seem to defy it. But further examinations using better telescopes showed that no, the redshift is cannot be explained by things like gravity. The redshifts we're seeing in galaxies is really from recessional speed. But there's other supporting means of telling that they're expanding from us. When we look farther and farther, we look into, yes, larger and larger spheres of distance, each sphere with twice the size. We use the volume of a sphere, which is 4/3 pi r³. So we know there's far more space there. And the galaxy should look smaller and dimmer in proportion to their supposed distance. And yeah, they do. Then we use type 1a supernovae, which is a supernova caused by two stars that are colliding with each other. They all give off approximately the same light, not exactly, but almost the same light at maximum. So we can use them as standard candles to tell how far away they actually are by comparing their apparent brightness with how bright we know they should be. That agrees also. So using all these separate methods, we're left with no mysteries so far as the fact of the expanding universe goes. Okay. It really is expanding.
Well, what do you think, Paul?
Well, I thank you for the response, and again, it's a lot to absorb, and I do look forward to reading your book, Bob.
Thank you.
Thank you, Paul. This one came in via email from Lee, who starts out, "Dear brilliant people," well, I would say person, not people, Bob. Well, no, the ambassador is here too, so we do have brilliant people in the studio. All right, and we'll throw this open to you as well, Ambassador Foucault. Lee writes, "A question that drives my roommate crazy. If one person is being spun around at the end of a 1,000-mile-long rope, the equivalent of standing on the equator, and is traveling at over 1,000 miles an hour, rotation of the Earth, wouldn't he or she weigh less than if he were simply standing on the North Pole?" Rumi says it's insignificant. That's
no, actually, the difference is about a pound. For a man who weighs about 200 pounds, you weigh a pound less on the equator thanks to the 1,038-mile-an-hour equatorial spin than you would. So if you wanted to set up a weight loss clinic and guarantee instant results and fly people down from polar regions and then say, well, we've got an office right in Quito, Ecuador, and sure enough, they lost a pound right away, hey.
Well, okay. I mean, easier just to have a salad, right?
Maybe for you.
All right, let's come on, Bob. Let's go to line three, and Fred and Wineskill. Fred, you're on.
Hi, Bob. Hey, I've read your book, and when I was in college many, many years ago, we read some empiricists, and there was a Bishop Berkeley who had a great dialogue, and he was trying to tell his friend how the fountain that he saw was only in his mind, and then he came back around and said, well, of course the fountain's there. So to see a book, and I get this whole thing about the mind, everything in the mind, and I used to think of people as like Santa Claus carrying a bag around with them, and that was time and space. So to see this book is wonderful. And I have a whole bunch of questions to ask. Can I ask them at your website?
Oh, that's great. And what is your website, Bob?
SkymanBob.com, but you could try one of them right
here. We only have about 2 minutes before the break, but you could certainly ask one of your more pithy ones.
So everything is observed. The world we talk about is observed, including all the stuff we observe through scientific instrumentation and through our math. So, but the only thing I can't get by is... And you guys use the word insensate. I use the word the nonsense world. I use nonsense because it's fun, you know, because you're not sensing it. But I keep thinking, but there's got to be something beyond all this these sensations, that when this energy of the universe, and I don't even like to say electrons or any of that, because those are sensed through our instruments. So it seems like there must be some kind of nonsensed something out there behind all this, and is there any way that we can ever know what that is? And to me, it's a wonderful mystery and mysticism that I think of when I think of this.
I think this is approaching mysticism.
It's great. I mean, what you're saying, what the caller is saying, is just really wonderful. You're expressing it as well as I could. If I'm to elaborate, you want me to get going now or wait till
you have 12 seconds?
I'll send your emails. There's one other thing, though. Why, if you divide infinity by two, do you get zero? Don't you still have infinity? That's another thing that's brought up in the book.
They say
when you divide infinity, you get zero. But isn't half of infinity still infinity?
Since infinity isn't a real number, you're really not talking about any number that you're going to get. But it's true. What we say in the book is if the universe really is infinite in extent, physical extent and in inventory, then what's within view is 0% of the universe.
Right. And so we know about 0% of the universe.
That's right. But you could alternatively phrase that as saying we know infinitely little of the universe.
Boy, I've heard that so many times before, you have no idea.
If that works better for the caller.
All right, the number to call is 800-348-2551. I sense we're approaching that lava lamp moment. It only happens once every five or six shows. Fire up the lava lamps, kids! Bob is here for a hippie, trippy final 20 minutes of the program in a moment.
Support comes from Real Seafood Company, Wolf Road Colony. Locally owned seafood restaurant and raw bar, realseafoodco.com. The Saratoga Jewish Cultural Festival, announcing the fifth annual series of 10 summer events, sponsored by Saratoga Congregations and Skidmore Office of Jewish Life. SaratogaJewishCulturalFestival.org for schedule. Ashfield Stone, Shelburne Falls, Massachusetts. Quarry and fabrication used for enduring landscapes and interiors, including countertops and floor planking. Rare and wonderful native stone of the Berkshires. AshfieldStone.com. Carrie Haddad Gallery, 622 Warren Street, Hudson, New York, announcing their 25th anniversary exhibition, now through July 10th, open daily, carriehaddadgallery.com. Amherst Copy and Design Works, offering printing and copying, sign making and design services from booklets to stationery and labels to lawn signs in downtown Amherst, Massachusetts. AmherstCopy.com. And TJ's Taylor Rental and Party Plus, owners Jim and Tamara Falcone, providing tool and equipment rentals, tents, bounce houses, water slides, and party supplies for events. TJ'sTaylorRental.com.
Vox Pop on WAMC. Ray Graff here. Number to call is 800-348-2551. We're joined today by astronomer Bob Berman. His latest book is Beyond Biocentrism, written with Robert Lanza, Rethinking Space-Time, A Consciousness, and the Illusion of Death. Also joined today by Ambassador Charles Fulco, NASA Solar System Ambassador. Nice to have you here, Mr. Ambassador. Do they have to call you that?
It's your ambassadorship.
Your ambassadorship. All right. All right. And the email address is voxpop@wamc.org. And let's see. Oh, we have a couple here. This one says, this is from Alan in Colony. I believe Taoism had a better view of the universe circa 800 BC, way before Western science. Comments on that, Bob?
Well, I wonder if the person who wrote has read the book. First read the book, then okay. See whether it's better or not. Actually, I'm not saying that our thing is better. It's just that we're based on science.
Okay.
And we give it to you so that you can say, oh, yeah, that makes sense scientifically. Whereas Taoism, they had their finger on the pulse without even needing to use science.
You see, look within. This is from Gary. And we'll throw this over to the ambassador, if you don't mind, Bob.
Sure.
Based upon reports I heard on the radio, WAMC, I tried several times to see Mercury at sunset back in early April when the weather conditions allowed. My location was where I found the best unobstructed view of the horizon at sunset. No luck. I don't think I saw anything but the stars as they became visible in the twilight. Was this possible, or was I misinformed? That's from Gary.
Gary could have probably seen Mercury a lot better on May 9th when it transited the sun, which is what I did. But Mercury is very difficult to see. In fact, most people probably have never even realized they've seen it because it's inherently close to the sun. Therefore, it's never seen in a truly dark sky, either in the morning or in the evening. So you have to really know when to look, where to look. And it does look kind of always yellowish to me, probably because of the atmospheric extinction going on. But Mercury is definitely there. It's what, about a magnitude 1 or better, Bob?
Yeah, not only was it there, but we had a program at Mohonk Mountain House in April. And we had crowds of people.
Really?
I'd say the better part of 100 people.
You're kidding me.
And everybody saw Mercury and oohed and aahed about it.
In the early morning hours?
No, it's the evening, sunset. So I think our caller just had bad luck.
All right, so we apologize for that. Yeah. All right, this one, and then we'll get back to the phones, comes in from Gregory via email. Subject heading, gravitational waves. Hey, can you kind of break down the recent findings of LIGO hearing gravitational waves and what it means for our universe?
Right. Well, first of all, when they say hearing, I know they use the word hearing. They used it in the press release, but there were actually no sounds. The idea was that it was Einstein's idea that things that generate extra gravity, let's say two giant stars colliding, would produce pulsations or contractions and expansions in the local space-time, which would then travel at light speed across the universe and should theoretically be detectable if you had devices that were shooting light back and forth from mirrors to mirror and then measuring very, very accurately. We're talking about the size of atoms accurately to see if there were any oscillations or changes.
And you need two far apart, right?
That's right. And apparently they did this and confirmed gravity.
That's pretty exciting news. Yeah. Okay, thank you for that. The number is 800-348-2551. The email is voxpop@wamc.org. Thomas wrote in, get with the program. For those who don't get it, read all of Neil Donald Walsh's books, which confirm Mr. Berman's assertions.
Good. I've not heard of his, but anyone who confirms my assertions
paid him off. Come on.
They've got to be a good guy.
All right, let's go back to the phones, and it's Malcolm's turn in Amherst. Malcolm, you're on.
Greetings, Bob and Ray. How are you?
I'm all right.
Well, I was just, I've been pondering, I've been doing a little bit of physics lately, and have been wondering if there's a connection between essentially the expansion of space and the phenomena of gravity in this sense. I learned, I think this is on Wikipedia and then confirmed through a few other sources, that the expansion of space is actually a measurable thing per parsec and that they know how much it is or something like that. And I couldn't crunch the numbers myself, but I figured it out this way. If you put any two objects if you think of a space between them, and kind of start relating to this a little bit with, I guess, in the calculus view, where if you want to compare that to the spaces outside of these objects, right? So all the distance on the far side of one object and all that expanding space and all the expanding space on the far side of the other object, and you compare all that expanding space to the expanding space between the two objects, and the expanding space between the two objects can never catch up. And wouldn't that explain why objects tend to move together towards each other, thus gravity?
I'm going to go get a drink. I'll be right.
Well, okay, let me take the last part of that first and go back to the first part. Gravity still is, no matter how you speak of it, is still mysterious. Of the four fundamental forces, it's the only one that's still mysterious. Now, it's true that when Einstein called it essentially geometry, the idea of the warping of space-time caused by the presence of mass, yes, that was a superior way of formulating it with his field equations than we used to have with the Newton way of thinking of objects actually exerting a mysterious force on another one as gravity. But even though Einstein made it more exact how it works, this still doesn't explain what it is, because space-time is not a real thing. It's not like a strawberry that you can analyze and see its nutritional content. It's a mathematical construct to tell how objects experience their separations and their time passages, which otherwise would be contradictory to each other. So given different gravitational fields and different motions, so that there's no contradictions, then everybody can say, oh, I see why he appears to be moving slower. If you use the field equations, everything makes sense. So Einstein did it mathematically as a way of making sense of everything. It's not like it's a real entity. So it remains mysterious.
Okay, and if it remains mysterious and scientists admit they don't quite get it, the strong force, the weak force, all of it, then how can we say then that dark energy exists if we don't know if gravity may explain all this?
Because dark energy is something else. If we see objects increasing their separation from others over time, we see a change, and we know that there's no obvious methods. There's no rocket engines igniting.
Well, how do we know that gravity doesn't have a reverse effect over long distances?
Well, what the MOND theory, M-O-N-D, is asserting is that dark matter may not exist because gravity may indeed fall off differently at weak levels than we thought. Charles earlier on today talked about the inverse square of light.
Yes.
That's how gravity falls off inversely with the square of distance. But what if at very low gravity rates it stops falling off inversely with the square of distance and starts falling off much more gently after that? If that's the case, then dark matter need not exist. But dark energy is something else, because that's showing us a overall expansion. The part two of this person's question was not understanding what the expansion of the universe is. And one of the reasons is it's usually listed as 70-something kilometers per second per megaparsec. And for some reason, astrophysics loves to use megaparsecs when it's not a very logical measure of distance. People can much more easily relate to light years, the distance light travels in a year. So if instead we express it as million light years, suddenly the expansion of the universe, also called the Hubble constant, is simpler. It's simple, and this is for the caller. It's simply that for every million light years we look away from us, objects are moving away from us 14 miles per second faster. Okay. Think of something that's 14 miles from Albany, where we're sitting right now. So 14 miles per second, faster speed, per million light years of distance. And then it suddenly becomes easy. You consider something that's a billion light years away. Well, that's 1,000 million. You'd multiply 1,000 by the 14 miles per second, and you'd know that the expansion of the universe a billion light years from us is 14,000 miles per second. You could do it in your head.
Okay. This one came in, I'll buy it. This one came in, said, warning, this is a lava lamp moment. And you and I were talking about cosmic rays briefly before the show started. Given that we have now confirmed the existence of cosmic rays slash particles, such as documented by the LHC, that we cannot visualize in the usual sense, nor can we see most types of waves, and they can pass through matter, what precludes us from presuming that other dimensions or existences slash universes are composed of those cosmic particles and accordingly coexisting but not codependent upon our dimensional existence? Check, please. I am now finished.
Yeah, well, we're finished, too, because when you're talking about other dimensions and other, dimensions of and creatures living in these other dimensions beyond the four that we know of, if you include time, there are no other dimensions that we know of. Even string theory that conjures as many as 11 dimensions in order to make it work is now being widely considered a failed theory. So we don't know of any other dimensions. All we can say is the caller brought up cosmic rays. We know that, which are particles, as he said, not rays, is that coming into our Earth and our bodies at all time are pieces of the universe that, interestingly enough, are proportionate to what the universe is made of. In other words, these particles, some of them come in almost at the speed of light. 90% are single protons, which make up the nucleus of a hydrogen atom. 10% are helium nuclei. And we get the nuclei of atoms in the percentage in which they exist in the universe coming in to Earth from all directions equally. Some come from the sun, but the ones that come from beyond the solar system are of unknown origin. We assume supernovae and others. They come from all directions. The only thing that's weird, well, there's two things that's weird. One is, why are there no electrons? Only 1% are electrons. And we know there's just as many electrons as protons in the universe, but only 1% of the cosmic rays are electrons, and 99% of them are either helium nuclei or protons. So where are all the electrons? Why aren't there electrons coming in? So that's a big mystery, mystery number one with cosmic rays. And mystery number two is a few of them come in at such high speeds that a single atom, particle, proton hits our bodies, if it hits us, with the same wallop as a baseball hitting us at 100 miles an hour. But atomic size. Imagine one of our atoms getting hit with a wallop equal to a baseball hitting us at 100 miles an hour, and that's just an atom causing that kind of impact. What could accelerate a little proton to that kind of speed? Because that's the only thing that gives it more energy is its speed. And the answer is, we don't know. Even supernovae can't explain that. So there are some mysteries with cosmic rays.
Bob Berman is our guest. Let's go to Michael in Schenectady. Michael, you're on.
Okay. Quick question. I was thinking about the expansion, and I had a theory, and I wanted to see if it was already out there, and that is whether or not the consumption of matter by black holes across the known universe can equate to the amount of force the universe is expanding at.
Well, first of all, I don't see why black holes swallowing up things should have anything to do with the universe expanding. Also realize that black holes have very, very bad press. They don't really do the bad stuff that we think they do. For example, if the sun should collapse into a black hole, like right now, it won't because only massive stars can collapse through a black hole. But if the sun should collapse, believe it or not, we'd continue orbiting it just as we did before. Our orbit wouldn't change in any way because the total mass and therefore the total gravity of the sun would remain the same. So it doesn't really gobble stuff up. In fact, black holes can only swallow things that come fantastically close. We have a black hole in the center of our galaxy weighing the same as 4 million suns, and presently it's starving. There's nothing falling into it because there's nothing, it's not pulling stuff in.
All right, let's go over to Lori quickly in Glens Falls. Lori, you're on.
Hi, Ray. I've got my lava lamp plugged in and it's not doing any good.
Oh, well.
Hey, no, for Dr. Berman, I wanted to ask I'm assuming with all this physics talk and stuff that's blowing my mind, it's when a tree falls in the forest and nobody there to hear it, it doesn't make a noise.
Well, no, of course not. Because a noise is something that it happens when we're there to hear it. You know, a noise is...
There you go. I probably got it.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Actually, when a tree falls...
We made a breakthrough here.
Yeah. When a tree falls in a forest, what's really happening, if nobody were around, were little air pressure differences, complex changes in air pressure, like little winds blowing. Yeah. But a noise? No. A noise means an animal. Only an animal can hear a noise.
All right, Laurie, great question. Well, we're just about out of time here. Do we want to get one more call in? All right, let's get a call in. Jay, you only have about 20 seconds, all right?
That's fine. Just wanted to put this out and ask this question. Now, given the technology we have, the understanding of the expansion of the universe, being able to actually quantify it, has anything been given the thought to giving our exact position within the universe, now that we know direction in which galaxies are expanding, where it's heading, can we better calculate and even postulate as to whether or not there is a center of the universe and where we are in relationship to it?
Yep. We are at the exact center of the universe. and the proof of that, is that we see everything in the universe expanding directly radially away from this spot that we locate, that we're located at. So it shows that we're the center. However, wherever you were located in the universe, you'd also see yourself at the center expand. And this isn't being like a wise guy or being metaphysical. It just means that everything is equally the center. And it also means that at one time there was only one center before the universe started expanding. And everybody carries a little piece of being that center with them to this day. So we're all equally in the center.
Our guest today was the great Bob Berman. His latest book, Beyond Biocentrism, Rethinking Space-Time Consciousness and the Illusion of Death, written with Robert Lanza. We're also joined today by Ambassador Charles Fulco, NASA Solar System Ambassador. Did you have fun?
I'm getting used to that title.
Will you come back, Ambassador?
I would love to come back.
Okay, great to have you all here. Thank you all for listening. Support comes from the 1850 House and Tavern, Rosendale, New York, a neighborhood tavern with a waterfront deck and a porch on Main Street, microbrew beers, local spirits, and pizza from their clay oven, the 1850house.com. Waterwheel Village, Galway, New York, a country store since 1923, offering aged cheddar cheeses, nostalgic candies, New York products, and gifts, waterwheelvillage.com. Maybe Farm Historic Site, Rotterdam Junction, presenting Schenectady Celtic Heritage Day, Saturday, June 11th, with live music, Irish dancing, pipe band, blacksmithing, sheep shearing, food, drink, and more, schenectadyhistorical.org. And Ashokan Center, building community through shared experiences in nature, history, and the arts, the Ashokan Center in the Catskill Mountains, where nature inspires, ashokancenter.org. Thanks again to Bob and the ambassador for being with us. Thanks to Zach Malloy, our engineer. Thanks to Deb Malik for answering the calls. Thanks to Jessica Blaustein Marshall, who is not here, but we can't prove that, so she might be here. I'm Ray Graff. Tomorrow it's a Food Friday, if indeed there is a tomorrow. The news is next, or maybe it's not.